Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you two, not in a creepy way.
Hey. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight, we are finally getting to this movie.
Why do you say it like that?
Have we been circling this movie for a while?
I think this is one of the ones that are inevitable, and for good reason. Tonight, we're going to talk about 1941's Citizen Kane, directed by and starring Orson Welles, and written by Herman Mankiewicz and Orson Welles. Nominated for a crap ton of Academy Awards, it won only one. Conspiracy? Yes. So, is this on everybody's list?
No.
It's definitely on my list. And I know it's on Jason's list.
Oh, yeah.
And Drew, you had seen this movie before? As a good cinephile?
I'm pretty sure I watched it with you when I was a little kid.
Oh, probably.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Turns out a little kid is not the time to watch this movie.
Yeah, no. Bad. Bad on you. Shame, shame.
So let's go around the horn.
Of all the movies I watched as a little kid,
yeah,
I think this one was fine.
Yeah. So let's go around the horn. Jason, the first time you saw it, do you remember liking it? What do you think about it this time you saw it?
Oh, yeah. I saw it probably, I would have been a teenager, so a long time ago. A long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far north. I liked it the first time I saw it. And I have watched it probably once a decade at least since then. And as I get older, I understand more and more and more of it. I know that I did not comprehend the entirety and the gravity and the masterpiece that it was when I watched it as a teenager. I had no foundation for understanding at that point.
And this time?
Rewatching it, it's amazing. It holds up fairly well since it's a period piece. It looks great. Even in my high definition home theater, it still looks amazing. And of course, Orson Welles is a commanding presence. So,
Drew, first time, recent time?
First time, a lot of it went over my head. I wasn't even really able to follow the Rosebud thing. I didn't really understand what it was about, what the point of it was, and found it to be pretty boring. Second time, because I don't think I've seen it since. I really don't think much has changed. I don't like this movie. And I know that means, I guess, I can't be a movie snob if I don't like this movie. But, yeah, I don't know. There are a lot of things I appreciate about it, but I don't find it entertaining at all. I find it really boring. And I don't really get the point. Maybe you guys can explain to me, like, what message this movie is trying to convey. I think Jason and I talked about this last week. I think it was an HBO movie about the making of this. movie?
Yes, Arcade 281.
Yes. Which I watched last night.
Oh, excellent.
I remember that being way more entertaining than this movie. I enjoyed that quite a bit. But I think the story and the mythology around it is way more interesting than the actual movie itself.
I think if you watch RKO 281, I think that's what it's called.
Yes.
I think if you watch that first and then watch Citizen Kane, you will appreciate it much. You'll get more. First of all, you'll get way more out of Citizen Kane. But also you can see it in a different light because you can see how it was made in a way and appreciate how well crafted it is. As far as what the story is trying to tell you, it's a morality tale. It's a tale of virtue and vice and hypocrisy.
I appreciate this movie as an accomplishment. Like I understand that it was, especially for its time, it was quite the achievement to just get it made. But like, I don't ever want to watch it again.
Well, that's fair. Yeah. Now, I have to say, I have been to Hearst Castle. So.
Oh, I have not. I want to go someday.
It's amazing. I have about 1,000 pictures, so I'm happy to share them.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It is awe-inspiring. It is amazing. It's amazing that entire compound was built. So,
did either of you watch The Battle Over Citizen Kane? The documentary that was on the Criterion set?
No, I have it. I just haven't watched it.
I recommend that you watch it. It's reviews of that movie. First of all, it shocked me because the producer of that movie was Thomas Lennon, but it's not the same Tom Lennon we know.
Oh.
although that Tom Lennon has done a million things and made $1 billion at the box office. This is a different Thomas Lennon.
Well, but I think the message of this movie, of RKO 281, is that the studios were trying, they were trying and hoping to censor it and destroy it.
Well, only after it was made, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Because they threw tons of money and resources at Orson Welles to get him to do something for them.
Right. Because they believed he was going to make a masterpiece, especially after War of the Worlds.
Let me just recommend everybody watches The Battle Over Citizen Kane, because it takes the parallel story of William Randolph Hearst and Orson Welles, because they have, at least the way the documentary unfolds, they have a little bit in common with each other. Okay, let me back up a little bit and tell you my reaction. So, Drew, let me assure you, this is an older brother giving a younger brother assurance. Since we're almost dead, it just seems silly now. But you are not liking this movie can actually make you even more of a snob if you want to lean on it. Because this movie was the number one movie. Actually, okay, so the history of the popularity of this movie is the movie was very controversial. So, and it was also, like, banned in Hearst newspapers.
Well, the studio buried it for almost a decade, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, what happened, yeah, they couldn't show it anywhere. Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, when they opened it, RKO actually had an actual theater that they had to put up a screen at to show it in New York City, because no other theaters would show it. Because then the Hearst papers wouldn't give them advertising. So the story of the movie is that, yeah, so RKO, because Orson Welles is a kid genius, like from the age of like 10, there was nothing he couldn't do. He was told he was a genius. Everything he touched pretty much turned to gold, kind of. He did really avant-garde stuff, and he was amazing. Like at again, he directed this movie when he was 25 years old. So RKO gave him an unprecedented, especially at the time, unlimited control of this movie. He had full editing. He had full rights to do anything he wanted. They gave him the budget to do it. And so he did it. In fact, when the studio came poking their heads around, they would like grab some baseball mitts and throw a baseball around until the guys walked away so they could finish shooting. And, you know, he was always known for doing things right at the last minute. Like he was really, really popular on radio. And he's also a stage director and a stage actor, but on the radio, he was super popular and he would do like more than one radio show a night. He would just show up at the studio and they would give him the script and he would just do it. I mean, he wouldn't rehearse necessarily at all. He was something of a maniac. Like he would stay up late for days. He wouldn't eat. And then he would eat like two steaks for dinner and then immediately go out and do stuff. I mean, he just did everything in these great sort of manic, fits. And he took on this, this story that I think, Herman Mankiewicz, the writer, the alcoholic writer, by the way, he was deep in alcoholism. In fact, they had to like ship him off to a different town. I think they sent him to like Victorville, California, and not give him booze. Like they sent a minder with him so that he could work on the script. And then Wells polished the script. And so, in fact, Wells actually tried to buy the name, like, so he'd be the sole author. But when the Writers Guild found out about it, they were like, no, you can't do that. But he tried to take on William Randolph Hearst, who was 75 years old and was not going to go quietly into mockery.
And is there a particular reason that Orson Welles had a problem with Hearst?
I think he was just a big guy. He was just like, he was a titan that maybe like the character of Charles Foster Kane in the movie was, you know, past his prime and kind of sad. But the real Hearst was still very formidable. Not only did he have the movie, the all the newspapers, but he also had these Hollywood parties, and so he had like Hedda Hopper and I forget the other girl's the other lady's name, the two arch rival gossip columnists. He could bury you. Again, this is where newspapers were a huge weapon. I mean, again, he created a war. The Spanish-American War was largely caused by the Hearst paper.
Oh, that's why Kane was like, are we going to go to war with Spain? You tell us.
Exactly, yes. Oh, totally, yeah. No, it famously Hearst sent a correspondent to Cuba or something, and the guy's like, there's nothing to do here. There's nothing going on. And he goes, you send me the pictures, I'll provide the war. Then that's what he did. It's amazing. And I mean, Hearst did a lot of things that were sort of unscrupulous, and where the movie shows Charles Foster Kane as being kind of idealistic, sort of, I mean, obviously a rich kid, but he starts off kind of really idealistic and trying to go for the common man. The Hearst story is a little more grounded. He had the vision of crushing his competition, but, and also, you know, trying to run for office too. And so there's a lot of the story that is really William Randolph Hearst. And so, you know, you thumb your nose at the old man and he was spry enough to take you down, which is what he did. I mean, this movie actually, it's the point of the documentary is this movie actually broke both men. Orson Welles did not recover from this movie.
No.
And Hearst did not recover from this movie either, because he was always going to be known as Citizen Kane. In fact, when his son died, the headline was Citizen Kane's son died, which is, yeah, pretty ugly. Yeah, and you couldn't, this movie could not be mentioned in any Hearst papers for years. Orson Welles was not mentioned in any Hearst papers for years. Although there is a famous story where Orson Welles and William Randolph Hearst were in the same elevator, and Welles asked Hearst to go to a showing, like a premiere of it, and Hurst was like, no, no. And as he was leaving the elevator, Wells was like, Charles Kane would have gone. But again, the arrogance of youth. The documentary talks about War of the Worlds and all that kind of stuff. I mean, again, Orson Welles was a big deal. William Randolph Hearst was a big deal. So this was a big movie. But this movie did a lot. I mean, there's so much stuff about this movie. And I guess I'll circle back to when I first watched it, I think I liked it because I was supposed to like it. Like, it was one of those things where you had to, you know, it was like a work of art you had to appreciate. So I think I just took it for granted that, oh, this is great. So, you know, that's pretty great. And then I watched it later, like probably 20 years later, and I found it kind of boring. And I watched it this last week, and I loved it. I really like this movie. Now, the fact that I actually don't like the number one movie on, like, Screen Something's top movies, because this movie was number one for the longest time. Maybe it's actually Empire Magazine, or maybe it's even AFI. But
the I thought it was one, AFI.
Yeah, maybe. The number one movie was this until maybe 2015 or something, and then Vertigo became the number one movie.
What?
Yeah, best movie ever made. Yeah, which I don't believe either.
Yeah, I don't know.
This movie was so stylish, and I thought the pacing was actually pretty good. It clipped along. It's got a weird opening because it has 15 minutes of a newsreel.
Yeah. Well, it's like master exposition. So purportedly I have the reason behind the feud between Wells and Hearst. So
okay.
Apparently Hearst was famous for throwing big parties for the Hollywood well-to-do elites in the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
He hosted these parties at San Simeon for the people, and then he would sign. He would have all the people come in and sign a guest book, and the guest book is part of the state park, so it's viewable to the general public. And apparently, Orson came to one of the gatherings with a couple of his friends, but by the time he had arrived, he'd violated Hearst's number one party rule, which was that they were absolutely drunk. And Hearst did not allow alcohol at his parties, perhaps, I don't know, because he just had a thing about alcohol, but mainly they're speculating that it was because he was worried somebody might be drunk and harm one of his pieces of art, since he had a lot of art around. But as a consequence of Wells being thrown out by Hearst, Hearst then had their names removed from the guest register, so there was no actual proof that they had ever been there. And that made Orson Welles angry enough. And so in a decision to do something, he decided he was like, oh, well, now I have a villain.
Yeah. Well, and Welles liked playing villains. He had a big, you know, he's a big guy. Even when he was young and more fit, he's still a big imposing presence with a very rich voice. So even, you know, age of, you know, early 20s, he was already being able to play like legendary villains and heroes too.
Eric, let me know if this rings a bell. AFI still lists Citizen Kane as its number one.
Huh. Do you have the top five?
Yes.
What are the top five?
Citizen Kane, Casablanca, Godfather, Gone with the Wind, Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow. I don't want to watch Gone with the Wind again.
Six is Wizard of Oz.
Huh.
Graduate, On the Waterfront, Schindler's List, and Singin' in the Rain round out the top 10.
Oh, I found Singin' in the Rain hard to watch.
I've never seen it. So my introduction to Orson Welles was when I was 9 years old. My friend Scott and I went to go see what at the time was probably the most amazing movie we'd ever seen.
Of course.
Transformers the movie. Which is a great batshit crazy movie.
You know, I believe that you've got the touch.
Yes. They killed Optimus Prime in that movie. They killed Optimus Prime. That is wild. But yeah, Orson Welles was the voice of the villain. The main, like, super villain, Unicron. And I think you and I were talking about Transformers the movie, and you were appalled that that's how I knew Orson Welles. So I think that's why we watched Citizen Kane.
Ah. See, what I should have done, what I probably also did, was have you listen to War of the Worlds.
Oh, yeah.
Because War of the Worlds, it's not even his best radio, because he did so much radio. But War of the Worlds was amazing. And also, that's more of a story than a... The story is better than the work of art.
Yeah, when I was an early teen, maybe even a tween, there was a TV show, War of the Worlds. Which is not great, but...
I loved that show.
Oh, I loved it too, but it wasn't great.
No.
Well, and then so they had it, and then they rebooted it within its own self.
Yeah, like the second season was completely different.
It was.
Well, you know, if see if you remember this, Jason. Jason, you and I went to visit Grandma Marge... Yes. And we were staying at a hotel in Tacoma, and they did a movie that had the War of the Worlds trick, where they came in and interrupted the movie with a live, I can't remember, it was like an asteroid coming to kill, to land, to destroy the Earth or something. But it was, the trick has been tried to be played many, many times. Never to that effect. And no. Actually, maybe not even, I mean... If you look at it, it's possible that a lot of the War of the Worlds hysteria was very localized and not as big as the newspapers said. But if you've ever seen the interview that Welles does with all the newspapermen, the late night, early morning after the Halloween performance in 1938...
You were aware of terror at the time you were giving this role. Were you aware that terror was going on throughout the nation?
Oh, no. Of course not. We did Dracula, and it seemed to me during Dracula I had high hopes that people would react as they do in a movie of that kind, and I don't know that they did particularly, and so I've given up. One doesn't believe in the radio audience, but you don't know that they're whether they're listening or not. You have no idea how many people are listening or what they're thinking. I had every hope that... that the people would be excited as they would be at a melodrama, but you don't play down the melodramatic effect of a melodrama.
Have you altered your plans for future problems in any way as a result of this incident?
Naturally, we will have to sit down and think very carefully about future broadcasts.
Have you made any specific changes in any programs that were already scheduled, such as next week, for instance?
No.
Mr. Welles,
three short stories. It was a mythical town, but it was near enough. It was near enough to a real name. I've forgotten how we figured it out. It's either that it's Grover's Mills, or it is Grove's Mill, or something. And at any rate, we changed it slightly, hoping that that was a thing which H.G. Wells did not do. His names are quite real English towns. Without any change name.
Do you think, Mr. Wells, that you might have taken unfair advantage of the public in using a map as a conveyance for authentic news?
I don't believe that I have since. It is not a method original with me. It is used by many radio programs. I am terribly shocked by the effect it's had. I do not believe that the method is original with me or peculiar to the Mercury Theater's presentation.
Do you think there ought to be a law against such enactments as we had last night, or as a result of that?
I don't know what the legislation would be. I know that almost everybody in radio would do almost anything to avert the kind of thing that has happened, myself included, but I don't know what the legislation would be. We simply, radio is new and we are learning about the effect it has on people. Learned a terrible lesson. The date of the broadcast was 1939, and it seemed, came rather as a great surprise to us that a story, the fine H.G. Wells classic fantasy, the original for so many succeeding comic strips and adventure stories and novels about a mythical invasion by monsters from the planet Mars should have had so profound an effect upon radio listeners.
It's amazing. He looks like white as a ghost. He's like, oh, we didn't know we were going to fool anybody, you know? Yeah. Oh, gee, we said in the very beginning it was H.G. Wells. It's a classic story. I don't know why anybody was, you know, oh, heavens, no.
Yeah, the day before lawyers, the time before lawyers would sue anybody for anything.
Oh, no. During the War of the Worlds broadcast, they were actually telling him from the control room that he needed to break into the story to say this was just a story. And he said no. And at the end of the first act, there's the reporter reporting from like Grover's Mill or whatever, dying of poison gas. And it just fades to dead air. And they held that dead air for the longest time. And basically the lore is that he timed it so that the first, because most everybody was listening to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, you know, that famous ventriloquist act on the radio, Candace Bergen's dad and Candace Bergen's more famous brother.
So isn't the mystique of ventriloquism lost if you can't see it?
Wouldn't you think?
Yeah.
He was very popular as a radio ventriloquist.
I think the three of us could do a ventriloquism act on the pod.
Well, not successful.
Well, that's the thing. There has been puppet versions of me. Very popular character, I'm told.
Well, anyway, so the idea was that first break in where they came flash news, you know, Grover's Mills, the aliens have landed, whatever. That was at the first commercial break of the program that Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy was on. And legendarily, people would like switch the channels during commercials like they've always have. So it was genius. All very carefully crafted to play this trick.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, he was a cunning man. So I have to correct myself. Apparently, I misremember, which is not surprising because I was younger. It was Orson Welles was filling in for Merv Griffin on the Merv Griffin Show.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Because he interviews Andy Kaufman.
Could he have been drinking a lot?
Oh, he was drinking a lot.
Yeah, Welles, no. I mean, not Kaufman.
Yes. Yeah, so I've sent you guys a link, a YouTube link. Actually, I don't think it's a YouTube link. It's a link to an article, but there is a YouTube video. But you should go watch it because it's painful. But that frozen foods commercial that I sent you is also painful.
We know a remote farm in Lincolnshire where Mrs. Buckley lives. Every July, peas grow there. Do you really mean that?
So in other words, I'd start half a second late.
Don't you think you really want to say July over the snow? Isn't that the fun of it?
If you make it almost when that shot disappears, it'll make my...
I think it's so nice that you see a snow-covered field and say every July peas grow there. We know a remote farm in Lincolnshire where Mrs. Buckley lives. Every July, peas grow there. We aren't even in the fields, you see.
Yeah, we are.
We're talking about them growing and she's picked them.
Yeah.
What?
In July.
I don't understand you then. What must be over for July?
When we get out of that snowy field.
When I was out, we were onto a can of peas, a big dish of peas when I said in July.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, always.
In July, yeah.
I'm always past that.
You are?
Yes. Okay. Well, that's about where I say in July.
Can you emphasize a bit in July?
Why? That doesn't make any sense. Sorry. There's no known way of saying an English sentence in which you begin a sentence with in and emphasize it. Get me a jury and show me how you can say in July and I'll go down on you. That's just idiotic, if you'll forgive me by saying so. That's just stupid. In July. I'd love to know how you emphasize in and in July. Impossible. Meaningless.
I think all they were thinking about was that they didn't want to...
He isn't thinking.
Wilson, can we just do one last...
Yeah?
And it was my fault. I said in July. If you can leave every July...
You didn't say it. He said it. Your friend. Every July? No, you don't really mean every July. But that's bad copy. It's in July. Of course it's every July. There's too much directing around here. Norway. Fish fingers, Findus, Norway. We know a certain fjord in Norway, near where the cod gather in great shoals. There, Jan Stangeland. Shit.
A fraction more on that shoals thing, because you rolled it around very nicely.
Yeah, roll it around and I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against. Because it's full of things that are only correct because they're grammatical, but they're tough on the ear. You see, this is a very wearying one. It's unpleasant to read. Unrewarding. Because Findus frees the cod at sea and then add a crumb crisp coating. Ah, that's tough, crumb crisp coating. I think, no, because of the way it's written, you need to break it up, because it's not as conversationally written. What?
Take crumb out.
Good. Here under protest is beef burgers. We know a little place in the American far west where Charlie Briggs chops up the finest prairie-fed beef and tastes. This is a lot of shit, you know that. You want one more? Yeah. More on what beef?
You missed the first beef, actually, completely.
What do you mean, missed it?
You're emphasizing prairie fed.
But you can't emphasize beef. That's like he's wanting me to emphasize in before July. Come on, fellas, you're losing your heads. I wouldn't direct any living actor like this in Shakespeare. Will you do this? It's impossible.
Orson, you did six last year, and by far and away the best, and I know the reason.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving it.
At the moment.
I spent 20 times more for you people than any other commercial I've ever made. You are such pests. Now, what is it you want?
No, I think
in your depths of your ignorance, what is it you want? Whatever it is you want, I can't deliver because I just don't see it.
That was absolutely fine. It really was.
You can't give me worth it. No money is worth it.
But kind of hilarious.
He became a sad parody of himself.
Well, was it really a parody? He just maintained his serious attitude.
I don't think so. I think he had a sense of humor, but I think he just...
You think that was a sense of humor?
No. I mean, I think he had demons, too. But I mean, in the interviews that I've heard, partly on the documentary and partly elsewhere, he kind of talks about, like, mistakes he's made. And, like, he actually really felt bad about how he treated Marion Davies in the movie, the Susan Cain character.
Mm-hmm.
He also, he thinks Rosebud was a cheap trick. He's like, that was sort of unnecessary. And, I mean, allegedly quite mean also.
Yeah.
But he, as an older man, he reflected a little bit more on that kind of stuff. But he was also a megalomaniac.
The depth of Mork and Mindy.
Well, see, that's the thing is, after this, after Citizen Kane, he made The Magnificent Ambersons, which was a very, like a huge project, but they took control away from him because he was over budget and Citizen Kane had already been a big thing. I mean, it eventually made lots of money, but it didn't make a ton of money at the time, I don't think. And so he never made himself. I don't think he ever made as complete a project as Citizen Kane afterward. Like, he starred in stuff. He worked for money. He was in the Muppet Show, for God's sakes. Muppet movie.
Oh, he did a ton of voice work, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, he worked because he needed the money. Shall we? I just got to say, I love Orson Welles. It's great. He's got a great voice. He's got a great story. He's just fantastic.
Well, and he had, for having not much experience, his eye for the film and the filming of Citizen Kane is amazing.
Oh, which he stole. I don't mean that in a bad way. He studied, he was watching movies like nightly while he was making this movie. Because he stole everything cool about it. Things about the fact that he had the camera always looking up at the main characters or the heroes and looking down at the minor characters and the villains. That was a thing, and it worked so well. And the fact that he used that huge, there's a name for it I can't think of, but the fact that he had like the huge depth of focus where you could have the foreground and the background be in perfect focus together, like long focus lenses or whatever. That's using the best technology and crazy angles and lighting. And I mean, now you could, I guess I could be accused of suggesting that was auteur bullshit. But it actually added to the storytelling quite a bit. It gave it gravity.
Well, and again, if I don't know how you viewed this movie. I watched it on my giant television set, and it still looks amazing. And there are a couple of spots where, like, okay, well, that's a matte painting, clearly. But even still, big pieces of the set were, I mean, it was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I watched this movie just as Orson Welles had intended, on my phone with one earbud in.
Yes, exactly. Me too. I watched it on a 4-inch screen. I had both ears, but still. Shall we dive into the plot?
Yes.
If we must, Drew says. By the way, patting ourselves on the back, or I'm going to pat myself on the back. Did you guys listen to the Valley of the Dolls episode?
Yes.
Yes.
I think we need to institute a new rule. One of us has to really hate the movie, and one of us has to be drinking throughout the whole podcast. You'll notice I did not edit out the ice. So.
Oh, also, I don't think I've recorded since your Sopranos ending.
Yeah.
Which. I was mowing my lawn while listening to it, and I had to stop to give you like a virtual golf clap.
Excellent.
That was awesome. That was tickling my funny bone for the rest of the day.
I wish I could say that was on purpose, so I'm going to say it was on purpose, but it wasn't. No, of course not.
You mean you didn't leave that song in the end on purpose?
No, that is more of an alien abduction sort of thing.
No, that was on purpose.
Yeah, this was just lazy.
No, that was, I mean, maybe, but purposefully.
It was great, though. I mean, it did work out, because we talked about The Sopranos. And
Yeah, that fucking movie, by the way.
Oh, I love talking about The Valley of Dolls. It was fun to listen to it as I'm editing it.
Oh, my God.
But before I even had an inkling about... how are you recording, man? I was chuckling to myself, telling my wife that we were going over the calendar. And I was like, yeah, you guys are doing Valley of the Dolls next. And Eric was asking me, like, well, you know, is there any movie over the next few that you don't want to do? And I was like, yes, Valley of the Dolls. Because you're doing that next.
It was so much fun. It really was.
You're saying shitstorm wrong.
Well, the thing you hated it for the every reason you hated it, I agreed with. I just didn't think it was all that bad. I thought it was highly entertaining. Although, again, looking through, because, you know, trying to get clips to find the music and stuff. Oh, it was, everything you said about it was absolutely true. It was horrible.
I only have one airline bottle left. Please don't make me crack it open.
Oh, it's so funny. Okay, so Citizen Kane.
Boyfriend Jesse was like, you were drinking? I was like, I had to. It was the only way I could get through.
So fun. I don't normally condone, you know, I wouldn't recommend it necessarily, but it worked. It was funny.
It's the only
it became
time ever...
a character in the show. The ice became a character.
It's the only time we've been podcasting that I've ever had alcohol.
No. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Seriously.
Man, I drink all the time.
So, time marches on. 1941. Newspaper tycoon Charles Foster Kane. By the way, 1941. This is a movie before World War II. For America, at least.
I was going to say.
Even though Hitler was in the movie.
Yeah.
So, anyway. 1941. Newspaper tycoon Charles Foster Kane, Orson Welles, is dead. The opening shot shows Xanadu. Kane's vast, elaborate, and now unkempt estate in Florida. Interspersed with segments of newsreel obituary are scenes from his life and death. The most puzzling are his last moments. Clutching a snow globe, he mutters the word Rosebud.
I have to say, as a child, I found the movie Xanadu way more entertaining than this movie.
Xanadu may be one I dip out on and let you guys watch together.
Oh God, when was the last time you've seen it?
When I was eight.
Okay, so boyfriend Jesse had never seen it, of course. And I think it was like a year and a half ago. Like, and I knew going into it, it was going to be awful. And I was not disappointed. It was awful. I knew all the music, of course, and could sing all the music, but it was awful. So it's a rough revisit. Just to warn you.
Not to Kubo Citizen Kane, but was Xanadu better or worse than Flash Gordon?
Oh, Flash Gordon was bad. The music was better.
I think that's a matter of perspective, because if you were a heterosexual male, you got to see, you know, Olivia Newton-John. So, but the movie makes a hard right turn three quarters towards the end, and then turns into a different movie. So, for Xanadu, and I haven't seen Flash Gordon since I watched it in the Albrecht's house. So,
yeah, Flash Gordon was goofy.
Go figure.
I watched in the theater with actually Uncle John and his friend Scott.
Nice.
Yeah.
I saw Tron with Uncle John in the theater.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I saw Clash of the Titans with Uncle John in the theater.
Yep. I saw Star Wars with Uncle John in the theater.
We skipped
to the front of the line because he pre-bought tickets. So we walked past a long line of people at the Polar Theater.
What a great uncle.
Oh, it's the best. Okay, so, by the way, you know, the whole newsreel thing, Time Marches On or whatever, it was kind of a send-up of, I can't remember what the real thing was called, but something like The March of Time. And it was all the, they always had obituaries that were really, like, overly, like, pompous, like, you know, death waits for no man. That includes blah, 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 who passed away at age whatever. They wanted the actual guy who had that rich voice that did all the newsreels of this particular brand to do it. And he wanted like $25,000. And so one of the guys who's like a bit player in this, or actually the guy who plays the reporter, he actually could do an impression of that guy. So Wells had him do it instead. So it's a guy doing the voice of the real guy for probably scale. Anyway, let's see. Kane, whose life was news and whose newspapers not only reported but formed public opinion, was central to this time, a larger-than-life figure. And the newsreel editor feels that until they know who or what Rosebud was, they wouldn't have the whole story of Kane. So he assigns a reporter called Thompson, William Alland, to investigate Rosebud.
How did anybody know what his last words were?
Well, it's supposed to be his maid, but then it turns out his butler heard it too, at least according to later in the movie. But anyway, so we actually get this kind of sort of a Rashomon kind of thing. Although the director of Rashomon, like I think 1950 or something, 50 something, said he had never seen Citizen Kane before.
Yeah, but Rashomon is a bunch of different points of view of the exact same circumstances.
Yes, true.
This is just different points of view of different periods of his life.
Yes. We get all these stories that none of which tell you about Rosebud. We first see Susan Alexander Kane, who is played by Dorothy Cummin Gore, who is the tycoon's ex-wife, who's drunk and won't speak to him. Then he reads the unpublished memoirs of Mr. Thatcher, played by George Kalouris, who is Kane's early financial advisor and childhood guardian, who later became the prime target of Kane's trust-busting newspaper attacks. In one of the many flashbacks, the Thatcher memoir shows Kane's mother, Agnes Moorhead, from
Bewitched,
signing guardianship of the boy and his fortune over to Thatcher, despite that his father's objection. Now, his father is kind of a brutish guy who said what the kid really needs is a good thrashing, which is why the mother sends him away. And it is noted in these notes, at least, that present-day fans of the film interpret this to mean that Kane, that Mr. Kane was abusive, But the 1940s audiences were more likely to believe that Mrs. Kane was overprotective, and that had Charles been allowed to grow up enjoying the love and discipline of his parents, his life would have turned out better. So, spare the rod, spoil the child, I think.
Interesting. That certainly was my take on it, was that she was sending him away because, yeah, his father was too physical.
Yeah, I thought so too, but it makes sense that because in the character arc of Charles Kane, he gets everything he ever wants and it's never enough. That's part of his story, is that he has everything and is still a shell of a man at the end. And he wants love that he can't get because
he's unlikable.
Well, and because he was sent away, never knew how to love. But yes, he was unlikable for sure. Anyway,
was there anybody in this movie that was likable?
Not particularly. I mean, I sort of like Jedediah, although he takes that weird turn at the end, like at the home.
I didn't find anybody in this movie likable.
So he's fabulously rich, goes off, gets kicked out of colleges and stuff. He's not really interested in the family business or any of that stuff, but he does think it would be fun to run a newspaper. So that really irritated his guardian.
Wait, this is another question I have.
Yes.
Was Thatcher a bad dude?
Not really. Thatcher was just a businessman who was in charge of this.
He was fine, right?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he ran the trust.
Yeah, and he seemingly provided very well for Kane.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I'm sure he made some money off of trust fees and everything, but it seemed like he did all right by Kane, and Kane was a complete dick to him.
Because Kane was a rebel, he rebelled against authority.
Yeah. Yeah.
Blah blah blah. Spanish American War. Blah blah blah. Using his journalism against his Trustmaster, whatever you call it. Executor.
I like Trustmaster.
So,
definitely makes him sound more like a supervillain.
It does, yes. And eventually, he loses his media empire. Which, by the way, Hearst never did. So, the point of the Thatcher story is that at the end, he tells Kane that even though he may be still a richer man, he never did anything with his money, like made the world better. He just bought stuff. And Kane speculated that if he had not been so rich, he might have actually become a much greater man and become everything that Thatcher hates.
That's the kind of shit only rich people get to say.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He might be played by Armie Hammer in this part of his life. Don't you think? You got to have somebody with that punchable face.
There would have been way more naked feet in this movie.
So next, well, only if Quentin Tarantino directed it. Next, Thompson interviews Bernstein, who we never find out his first name, played by Everett Sloan. And he is the general manager of Kane's newspaper empire. And they recall that Bernstein and Jedediah Leland, played by Joseph Cotten. By the way, Joseph Cotten is a freaking... and all these people, all of the main characters were all Mercury Theater alumni and not known for being motion picture actors. This was all of their debuts. And if you've ever seen The Third Man with the Joseph Cotten as the lead and Orson Welles as the bad guy, it's a really good movie. And has a zither.
Zither?
Yes, zither music.
Thank you.
And Joseph Cotten has also done great stuff in the radio, too. Also, Agnes Moorehead, great stuff in the radio. Anyway, so we find out that they took over the unprofitable Inquirer paper and transformed it into a money-making enterprise and eventually bought the staff of the much more popular New York Chronicle. So then we... Thompson seeks out Leland, who then tells the story of Kane's first marriage to Emily Norton, who's Ruth Warwick. And Leland kind of makes some negative comments about Kane's character. He says, "Charlie was never brutal. He just did brutal things. He married for love. That's why he did everything. That's why he went into politics. It seems we weren't enough. All he wanted was the voters to love him, too. All he really wanted to life was love. And he lost everything."
Here's where you cue a Dionne Warwick song.
Well, the thing is, he didn't have any love to give. That was Leland's assessment. So then they go on to describe Kane's second marriage to Susan Alexander. And Kane started to see her while he was still married to Emily. By the way, this is in real life where Hearst's mistress, Marion Davies, actually was his mistress all the way into his death. And she was not the alcoholic, horrible person that that Susan Alexander in the movie was. Although she did like puzzles. And the real Marion Davies is reputed to have had an affair with Charlie Chaplin, who's got his own sexual skeletons.
And she was the one that had Rosebud, right?
Yeah, theoretically, that was her clitoris.
Just going to let that one hang there.
Yeah.
I have no point of reference, so.
You've heard of it, right? In the South Park movie, at least?
Anyway. Mythical creature.
Exactly. So, Kane goes up against political boss, Boss Jim Geddes, played by Ray Collins, who is the devil. Of course, Ray Geddes.
Where's he from?
Where is he from?
We see him later in, is it Perry Mason?
A police chief or something in Perry Mason?
I think so.
I'm trying to guess. Are you looking it up?
I am. Because as I said that, I doubted myself. So now,
because he, he wasn't Paul, and he wasn't Hamilton Burger, Hamburger.
Ray Collins, Perry Mason, Lieutenant Tragg.
Oh, there we go.
I knew I recognized him from somewhere. I'm like, that's pretty sure it's Perry Mason. I was right. So, yay. Wow. He has done a shit ton of movies, by the way. He had 111 credits.
All these guys and gals worked. They were all good actors, and they were working actors.
He was in Orson Welles' Magnificent Ambersons.
Again, and like Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles were in a lot of stuff. I want to see Touch of Evil, because I haven't seen it yet, and I've only heard like it is also a fairly historic movie.
Huh. I'll put it on the list.
Yeah, it's Charlton Heston and Orson Welles. And it opens with a very, very long shot.
Charlton Heston, Janet Leigh.
So, Jim Geddes, blah, blah, blah. Geddes finds out about Susan and threatens him, basically, to leave the race. And he does not. So, he does not quit the race, and he ends up losing. Even though he was supposed to win by a large margin, whatever. Anyway, he ends up marrying Susan. And she is something of a singer, or wants to be a singer, or something. And so, even though she has no talent in the movie, Marion Davies actually was fairly accomplished at what she did, apparently. But, Susan is a bad singer. And he basically forces her into being popular by force of will. Against her own will, because she actually has a suicide attempt in order to stop singing. So, let's see. We are going to Kubo this movie, aren't we?
This movie's too long not to.
Well, I mean, then we basically go to Florida, where Susan has kind of retired to sort of, she ends up being a lounge singer and a drunk. and they talk about Xanadu. Cost, no man knows.
Well, okay, in the interest of not kubo-ing this movie, I mean, we skipped over a lot of Kane's life. So you called him a rebel in his early life. So when he was running the newspaper and he was attacking his trust master. Okay, so he was a young man. He was just being a dick because he could be. But as he got older, you know, and he was running for office, like, what was the point of that part of the story? What were we supposed to take out of that?
The ego.
Yeah, we were supposed to take, he had ego, and I think at that point, that was the turning point where the theory was he was going to be able to topple the political boss, the bad guy, and he could be the good guy. But instead, he lost and became disillusioned and then became a bitter guy.
Well, I think also the point is that he tried to say that he was going to run because he was going to get rid of all the crooks.
Yes.
And he was tired of the hypocrisy and the filth. But the irony or the happenstance is that he was having an affair. So he was as flawed as the people he was trying to replace. So.
Well, and he was always playing these dual roles. Like, even the whole thing with Thatcher was that he was trying to bust these trusts, but he was also like the largest shareholder of the biggest company he was against. And he said, yeah, as a shareholder, I'd be, you know, I'd want to run Charles Kane's newspaper out of town and whatever. But as a newspaperman, I will bury the trust or whatever. Because he just wants to see it burn.
Because it sells papers.
Well, also because he doesn't believe that it is worth anything. Does that make sense? Maybe I'm reading too much into it. Like, he's got so much money, it doesn't matter. Like he said, look, if he loses $1 million a year, he could still run the paper for the next 40 years. Ha-ha. And eventually he buys all this art and stuff and buys all this land and ends up, you know, becoming a prisoner in his own castle. And finally, you know, Marion leaves him and everybody leaves him and he's alone looking at his snow globe.
Yeah. So when his first marriage falls apart,
his wife and his son die and they don't have mentioned ever again, right? Like a car crash or something.
Yeah.
Yes. Car crash.
It's out of just sheer stubbornness that he marries his second wife and tries to make her a star, right?
What?
Oh, sorry. I mean, yes.
Whoa.
Wow.
Oh, Jesus. Was that Freudian or on purpose? Oh, Lord.
Does this that was, familiar? We can.
That was savage.
Wow.
Savage. And only four people will appreciate it.
I completely forgot what we were even talking about.
Doesn't matter. we should end the show on that note. That was worth watching this movie.
I think the point is that he married her and wanted to make her a star because he believed that she would become great because she was with him and he was going to help her.
He will make her great.
That's right. Because he has that power.
That's right. Because he's Charles Foster goddamn Kane.
Yeah.
What I took out of it was he was kind of a laughing stock for having an affair with this woman and they put singer in quotation marks. So he married her, right, to prove that it wasn't just a fling. It must have been true love. And then he tried to make her a star so that he could prove people wrong, right?
Yes.
Even though she didn't want to be a singer. That was what she told him when she first met him.
Maybe her not mother, even married.
Yeah, her mother wanted her to be a singer, and she wasn't really interested.
No, and I like the singing lessons, by the way.
where the teacher was like, you're terrible, we need to quit.
Yes.
It's like he hired Simon Cowell as a teacher.
He did.
But also, if she's terrible as a singer, it takes away, it takes the spotlight off of him. So people are no longer talking about what a horrible guy he is. Instead, they're talking about what a horrible singer she is.
And you think he wanted her to be a bad singer?
Oh, no.
I don't think so. But I think that if she failed, he knew that it would deflect all the bad things off of him. And it would immediately be completely sublimated to her.
No, I don't think so. I think he was very angry as the clapping scene demonstrated that he was like a certain president. He looked at the facts and looked right past them, and he was going to use force of will to just say what was right and what was not. She was a great singer because he said she was a great singer. Facts be damned.
Yeah. So instead of just having a lawyer pay her off, he married her and tried to make her a star.
Yes. And she pays the price as much as he does.
And who hired the car that killed his first wife and child?
That's dark.
Dun dun dun.
Steve Bannon.
Yeah. Actually, I think maybe Bernstein. They were gonna blame it on the Jew. John Bolton. Anyway, at the end, they, you know, the reporter's like, well, we never found out what Rosebud is, and we can't really, you know, we don't know. And then they kind of sum it up with, I don't think any word explains a man's life. Like, Rosebud could never have summed up his life because he was such a complex man, blah, blah, blah. But it turns out,
Juicy got you crazy.
Well, and that, as Lisa Simpson has taught you, Rosebud is a sled.
The ending of this movie, where the reporter's talking about how we'll never know, it reminded me of like when I'm just trying to move our discussion along. I'm like, don't know, doesn't matter.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, thanks, cool. I just sat through this whole movie to find out. Doesn't matter. Awesome. Fuck you.
But if he had only been able to stay at his modest little, well, actually he got rich because they found gold on his parents' small property, right?
Border couldn't pay his bill, so he gave the mom what he thought was a worthless mining claim.
Yes, and turned out to be one of the largest mines, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Bernard Herrmann score. I mean, this is a big movie. It felt big.
Yeah.
This was the Rock Band Queen type of movie. It just felt huge. Now, is it the Rock Band Queen playing bicycle races, maybe? I don't know. It's in my say. Can't all be Bohemian Rhapsody.
How you feeling over there?
So now that we've Kubo'd Citizen Kane, the number one AFI movie of all time, which, by the way, again, I think this movie, this and like Casablanca, deserve that kind of praise. There are things Drew's right about as far as this is actually an historic movie because of all of the fact that it's been copied a billion times. Like, this is why Pulp Fiction exists.
What?
I mean, there's a straight line to it.
Please elaborate.
Yes, please expound upon that.
We got jumping around in time. We've got the long camera shots. We've got the close-ups. We've got, I mean, all of these techniques directors after this have copied. In fact, looking at the reviews at the time, a lot of the movie reviewers at the time thought this was a great movie. All of the Hearst newspaper reviewers weren't allowed to review it. And when you got to Europe and they watched this movie, you had people like Jean-Paul Sartre, who was doing movie reviews apparently as well, talking about how this is a movie about the past and movies must be about the present. And then the Russian movies, because a lot of the best, like number one movie in contention was like Battleship Potemkin or something. And so the Russian directors are like, no, this movie is all about narrative and it should have been about montages like the Russians do. So it was all like political artsy bullshit about how, you know, it was just telling a simple story. It wasn't aspiring to be anything more than entertainment. Therefore, it was not worthwhile. So, fuck you, Sartre. Actually, I don't have any feelings about Bones, but
are you sure? It didn't sound like it. It sounded like you had a pretty strong position there.
I think my general feeling is philosophers can eat a dick. I mean, you can quote me or whatever.
Wow. That's deep.
Hey, when I was a teenager and even maybe in my early 20s, I thought Jim Morrison was a poet, so I don't know shit about shit. So, Brother Jay, notes? Notes on
nope,
this
movie? I took no notes.
I highly recommend the documentary.
Yep. I will watch it. I have the 2-disc collector's edition.
That's true. So. It's funny. I have the 2-disc collector's edition also. I don't know where it is because I fucking my house is in disarray. But I got it from the library. And in fact, I got that. And I also got the documentary. Turns out when I opened up the Citizen Kane movie, it contained an extra disc that had the documentary on it. So I had 2 versions of the documentary. but by the way, nice. So, okay. So Jason, you want to give it a grade?
This is an A movie.
I can agree with that. Drew, was it worth it?
That's a tough one. Because this movie has... It has an undeniable cultural footprint, right? Undeniable. And yeah, it's worth it because it's well made. It's really interesting to look at. The whole reason I love black and white movies are because they are visually so different with the specific lighting. And this movie is really visually interesting. The things that Orson Welles does with the camera and the lighting are amazing. It looks great. The makeup effects of aging a young Orson Welles into an old man. Actually, most of the old people makeup looks pretty good. But the Kane stuff, especially, looks great. And good performances, even though there's a lot of melodrama. But the story itself, I couldn't get behind. Didn't really see the point, and I was really bored. Just bored the whole time. I have no interest in watching this again, but I do have an interest in watching RKO 281.
I like I said, I watched it last night, and it's fantastic. Also, because it has Roy Scheider, so
yeah, it also has got Oliver very, Platt, James Cromwell,
very right? Young Liev Schreiber.
Liev Schreiber.
Oh, Oliver it's not Platt. Oliver Platt. It's Liev Schreiber. Schreiber.
Ah, and Malkovich.
Ah, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Malkovich plays Mankiewicz.
Ah, okay. So is James Cromwell in it? Is he Hearst?
Yes.
Okay. By the way, if you look at real Hearst, he looks like a ghoul.
A ghoul.
Yes.
Didn't Donald Sutherland just play him on a TV show?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe.
Trust?
Oh, maybe. Don't know.
Huh.
Anyway, who plays? You were saying somebody else in RKO 281? Oh, yeah. Who plays Marion Davies? Who plays...
God damn it. Melanie Griffith, I think.
Oh.
Let me double check.
I'm very much looking forward to watching. And we're talking about that the next time three of us get together, right?
I moved the calendar around a little bit. We need to talk about the calendar. But yeah, okay. We can do that.
Yeah, Melanie Griffith plays Marion Davies. They have Schreiber as Orson, James Cromwell as Hearst, Malkovich as Mankiewicz.
And again, I think I'm looking forward to watching that because I truly believe the mythology surrounding Citizen Kane is way more fascinating than the movie itself.
Yeah, it takes quite a bit of poetic license because it abbreviates large spans of time where there was no movement. But it's also only about, I think it's, well, let me double check. I think it's only like an hour and a half long. It's not a long movie.
Even better.
Yeah.
1 hour 26.
So to end up the Citizen Kane talk, at least for my end of it, I think it's actually sort of required viewing. I mean, I don't like to give people assignments, and I think I always resented assignments anyway. Like Gone with the Wind, I fell asleep during Gone with the Wind, and I will not be returning. It's like I just can't. I'm trying to think of other movies that are similar to that. Maybe Wizard of Oz. Don't know. That might be interesting to watch. But again, there's a lot of history involved in being more than just fun. So anyway, but yeah, I think Citizen Kane, if you haven't seen it, you should see it. If you like movies, if nothing else, you'll see reflections of every movie in this movie.
That is true.
So, calendar, I have a suggestion. I'm hoping that all of us can do it. But thinking maybe Jason and I, if Drew was not into it, I want to watch both versions of the Thomas Crown Affair. Steve McQueen and Pierce Brosnan.
Oh, I'd be totally into that.
Okay. Jason?
I've never seen either of them, so.
Are you thinking about a twofer episode?
Yes.
I also had a suggestion. I think, Eric, you'll be into it. Jason, I don't know if you'll be into it. But I read an article today on the website Slash Film about how the Francis Ford Coppola and Kenneth Branagh movies, Dracula and Frankenstein, are actually a really interesting pair of movies to watch together.
Yes, I'm in. Partly because I've got some problems with Dracula.
Yeah, the thesis of that article was that both of those movies elevate the other one.
I hope so. Okay. So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on Films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here. Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on Films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies, so they go off on a tangent flow and maybe rambling. That's the Brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey. Not in a creepy way. 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 Okay. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey, Joe, hey.